So I want you to imagine that you are crammed inside this really musty, stifling rug chest.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Right. You barely have room to breathe. Your knees are totally pressed up against your chest, and the air just smells like, old dust.
Yeah, totally claustrophobic.
Exactly. And outside this wooden box, there's this brutal, seemingly undefeated knight who is stripping off heavy, clanking armor.
Okay, the tension is real here.
It really is. You're holding your breath, just waiting to see the face of this terrifying warrior. But here is the catch. You aren't watching this on a movie screen, and you aren't reading it in some polished, published novel.
No, you're actually watching it unfold line by line. It's being generated in real time by strangers typing on keyboards in an early 2000s internet chat room.
Yeah, and that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. Today, we've got our hands on a really fascinating artifact of internet history.
It's a gold mine, really.
It totally is. We are looking at a highly detailed chat log from a text-based online role-playing campaign. It's set in the fantasy world of Mirari.
And we should mention this campaign was moderated by Conrad Wong and Mae Wasserman.
Right, yeah. And the specific log we're digging into today is titled Log Entries, Legends, When Thomas Met Redmayne.
I think it's important to really understand the medium here before we dive into the story itself.
Oh, absolutely. Set the stage for us.
Well, for you listening, if you've never participated in an early 2000s text role play, you have to picture a blank screen and a blinking cursor.
Just a cursor, nothing else.
Exactly. There's no voice chat, no 3D graphics, no pre-rendered cutscenes. You literally only exist through what you type.
Which is wild to think about now.
It is. And yet, the players in this specific log managed to execute what is essentially a masterclass in collaborative real-time storytelling.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because I really want to ask you, the listener, have you ever wondered how groups of people build these intricate living worlds entirely through text and shared imagination?
It's a huge undertaking.
It really is. Like, how do you create tension or manage pacing and build deep lore when literally anyone in the chat room can change the direction of the entire story with just a single sentence?
Well, it requires an incredible amount of unspoken coordination.
Unspoken being the key word there.
Right. It's a lot like improvisational jazz, but imagine everyone is playing a different instrument, nobody agreed on the key beforehand, and your only way to communicate is through the notes you play.
Huh, that sounds like chaos.
It can be. But to really understand the brilliance of this specific log, we have to look at the mechanics of how the players set up the board.
Right, because they don't just start swinging swords.
No, they immediately subvert the standard expectations of a fantasy narrative.
They really do. And I think it starts with the framing device. The whole log is actually a story within a
A
story.
classic setup.
Yeah. We begin in the present day of this game's timeline at a place called the Hawksmoor Archives.
Which is a great setting.
Definitely. And we have Lord Thomas, who is this veteran, slightly cynical lord explorer of a faction called the Golden Hawks.
He's kind of the grizzled veteran type.
Exactly. He's gathered his friends and some new recruits, and he's going to tell them a flashback story about something called the Year 36 Spring Tournament.
What's fascinating here is how the players use familiar tropes to anchor the story, but then they deliberately break them to signal to the other players what kind of game this is going to be.
It's like setting a baseline just so you can mess with it.
Precisely. The veteran recounting his glory days at a tournament is a very standard fantasy trope. It makes everyone comfortable.
Yeah.
But then, well, then the details arrive.
Right. So the flashback introduces the threat. There's this unknown Black Knight who is just absolutely dominating the jousting tournament.
Sounds pretty standard so far.
You'd think so, yeah. If you're playing a classic fantasy game, you expect the Black Knight to be wearing, well, black steel or maybe some spiky dark iron.
Very typical Dark Lord aesthetic.
Exactly. Instead, the player typing out the description of this knight goes in a totally different direction. The armor is described as primitive and oceanic.
Oceanic.
Yeah, it's shaped like nautilus shells and clamshells with a face guard that looks like a mass of tentacles.
Think about what that does mechanically in a text-based medium, though.
Oh, it changes everything.
It does. In a chat room, you don't have a visual character designed to show people. Your words are the only camera you have.
Right.
So by describing armor made of nautilus shells in a standard medieval setting, the player is essentially hanging a massive blinking neon sign over the character.
Like, hey, look at me.
Exactly. A sign that says, "This is not a normal combat encounter, this is a puzzle." It's an invitation to the other players to investigate rather than just attack.
And the person who actually takes that invitation and initiates the plot is Princess Alexandra.
She's such a great character.
She really is. She sends a message to Lord Thomas, basically summoning him. She's worried this weird nautical knight is going to win the tournament, get an audience with the royal family, and potentially assassinate them.
Which is a valid concern.
Totally. But Alexandra is not your typical damsel in distress waiting in a tower.
Not at all. The player controlling Alexandra uses her royal status not as a handicap, but as an active tool for espionage.
I love how she plays it. It's like a medieval fantasy version of an undercover sting operation. Ah,
that's a perfect way to put it.
Right. But the person pulling all the strings, like the Q to our James Bond, is the teenager they're all supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, she's a total mischievous mastermind.
She scouts the location. She points out the target to Thomas. She even manages the diversions.
And that completely subverts the power dynamics usually found in this genre.
Completely.
The players have silently agreed through their typed actions that the teenage princess is the handler and the veteran Lord Explorer is just her operative.
It's brilliant. It shifts the entire focus from a story about brute force to a story about information gathering.
Which brings us to how these players actually execute a fantasy investigation in real time.
Yes, the tense scene. This is where we started. So, with the stakes established by Alexandra, Thomas decides to sneak into the Black Knight's tent while the knight is out jousting.
High stakes snooping.
Very much so. And as I was reading this log, I found myself trying to figure out the mechanics of how they pulled this off.
It's tricky to do in text.
Yeah, because Thomas sneaks in and he doesn't just look around. The player typing for Thomas actively writes out that his character sniffs the air.
That's a very specific action to type.
Right, and he detects the uncomfortable metallic scent of iron.
Let's break down the mechanism of that interaction. Because in a text game, there is a constant dance between the players and the game master or moderator.
Like a call and response.
Exactly. The player controlling Thomas probably typed an action, something like, Thomas steps into the tent and searches the area, taking in the sights and smells.
Right, keeping it open-ended.
Yeah, because the player doesn't actually know what's in there. It's the moderator, Conrad or May, who then replies to that prompt by typing out the sensory detail about the scent of iron.
Which is a massive clue, because we learn through the chat that in the world of Mirari, iron is bane to the Fae.
Right, it's highly toxic to them.
Exactly, it's deadly. So finding iron weapons immediately turns this weird knight into a major political threat.
It escalates things quickly.
It does. And then Thomas also finds these unfamiliar runes carved into green lacquered chests.
Information is really the currency of this scene.
Yeah, totally.
The moderator is feeding puzzle pieces to Thomas's player. You know, the iron, the runes. But then the pacing subtly changes.
Oh, man, yeah. The knight returns to the print unexpectedly.
Cue panic mode.
Total panic mode.
Yeah.
Thomas quickly casts a magical glamour, which in this world is basically an illusion spell, to make himself look like a ratty, unassuming squire just in case he gets caught.
A good backup plan.
Yeah, but he decides his best option is to literally dive into a musty rug chest and hide.
This is where the concept of out-of-character versus in-character knowledge becomes really critical in a chat room.
How so?
Well, the player controlling the knight can read the chat log.
Right.
They know exactly where Thomas is hiding.
Oh, right. They can see all the text.
Exactly. But their character doesn't know. So they have to intentionally role-play ignorance.
That must be so hard.
It requires a lot of trust. They're typing out actions as if they're completely alone, creating this incredible dramatic irony for anyone reading the text.
Which makes it so tense. So the knight starts removing that heavy Nautilus armor, and we get the big reveal.
A moment of truth.
Right. The towering, brutal combatant is actually a tall, red-haired woman. And Thomas, who is peering out from the chest, notices the scent of her flowery herbal soap.
It's a total shift in the narrative paradigm.
It is. But I have to push back here on the hero's methods for a second.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, hiding in a chest while someone bathes is a massive violation of privacy.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Even for a fantasy spy trying to save the kingdom, it feels incredibly creepy. I mean, he broke about half the knightly vows in 1 minute. Why do we accept this as heroic?
It's definitely a boundary violation, I'll give you that. But this actually highlights a really fascinating psychological quirk of role-playing games.
What's that?
Players often abandon their characters' stated moral alignment, like, you know, knightly chivalry, when they enter what I call the escape room mentality.
Escape room mentality, I like that.
Yeah. To the player playing Thomas, the tent isn't a private bedroom. It's a level in a video game.
Ah, I see.
And the knight isn't a person with a right to privacy. She is basically a puzzle dispenser.
Oh, that makes total sense. He's not thinking about the ethics of voyeurism. He's just trying to click all the objects in the room to get the lore drops.
Precisely. Gamers prioritize solving the mystery over preserving social norms.
Fair enough.
And from a storytelling perspective, the player's choice to use non-combat skills, you know, the stealth, the glamour, the observation, it really pays off.
It definitely does.
By gathering these specific clues, the deadly iron, the gender reveal, the flowery soap, the players collaboratively shift the narrative genre.
Right. It's no longer a story about a physical threat, some big scary guy in armor.
Exactly. It's a political and personal mystery now. Who is this woman and why is she really here?
So after gathering all these clues and almost suffocating in a rug chest, Thomas needs to process what he's learned.
And where do you go to do that?
Right. In a fantasy setting, you go to the ultimate fantasy social hub, the tavern.
Of course.
In this case, a place called the Merry Maiden.
The transition to the tavern is actually a crucial pacing mechanism.
How so?
The players have just spent a lot of time in a high-tension, claustrophobic environment.
Literally inside a box.
Exactly. So the tavern offers a release valve. It transitions the story into an ecosystem of diplomacy, lore, and petty politics.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This tavern scene is an absolute masterclass in how a decentralized group shares the spotlight without talking over each other.
It's very impressive.
Which, honestly, in a chat room where the loudest person is just the person who types the fastest, is really hard to do.
Oh, it requires immense discipline. You have to actively choose to leave space for other people to exist in the scene.
And they do it so beautifully. Thomas walks in and finds translator Oberia.
Okay, setting up the handoff.
Exactly. He hands her a rubbing of the runes he copied from the green chests in the tent. This is a deliberate pass of the baton.
Yes.
The player playing Thomas is basically saying, I gathered the clue, now it's your turn to shine.
Sharing the narrative weight.
Right. And Oberia's player gets to drop some massive world-building lore. She decodes the runes, revealing they belong to the Fomorians.
The sea giants.
Yes, from ancient era. She types out this whole history about how they were peaceful giants with goat heads who built these grand castles by the sea.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, think about how this applies to modern remote work or digital team dynamics.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Right. How often do we struggle to balance extroverts and introverts on a Zoom call or in a Slack channel?
Constantly.
These players are demonstrating how to manage an asynchronous shared space. Oberia's player is given the floor to establish deep, ancient history that makes the universe feel lived in.
And nobody steps on her toes.
Exactly. Nobody interrupts her lore drop with a random sword fight.
Well, nobody interrupts her with a sword fight, but there is some brilliant crosstalk happening.
Oh.
Yeah, because while Oberia is decoding ancient goat giant history, we have minstrel Sam typing out the lyrics to a boisterous ballad.
Of course there's a minstrel.
Naturally. He's singing about a hero named Hildegard, the huge fighting hobgoblins in East Grub.
Which acts as a diegetic soundtrack.
Diegetic meaning?
Meaning the music isn't just background noise for the reader. It's actually happening within the world of the characters, and they have to react to it.
And react they do. Oberia actually pauses her translation to yell at the minstrel and correct his artistic liberties.
Oh, I love that.
It's great. She points out that historically, Hildegard didn't just use brute force to beat the hobgoblins. She actually used drugged wine and military strategy.
A stickler for historical accuracy.
Very much so. It's this hilarious petty debate between historical accuracy and writing a catchy pox song, and it's all playing out in real-time text.
It gives the world incredible texture.
It really makes it feel alive.
It does. It shows that Mirari isn't just a cardboard backdrop constructed for the heroes to walk in front of. It has its own culture. It has its own academics arguing with its own artists about how history should be recorded.
It's so layered.
The players are weaving all these threads simultaneously. The translator handles the lore. The minstrel handles in the atmosphere.
And Princess Alexandra handles the politics.
Naturally.
Because right in the middle of this cozy tavern atmosphere, a character named Sir Eric of House November walks right up to Thomas and straight up slaps him across the face.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah. He calls Thomas a traitor to their house. It's a shocking, violent breach of the tavern's peace.
Now, in a lesser roleplay game, the player controlling Thomas might take that as an invitation to start a massive tavern brawl.
Which is always tempting.
But look at how he reacts here.
He doesn't draw his sword at all.
Right.
The player types that Thomas simply rubs his face and groans about politics.
He just brushes it off.
Totally. He completely deflates the physical tension because his character understands the complex web of house rivalries. He knows a bar fight won't actually solve a political grudge.
But the teenage mastermind, Princess Alexandra, is watching.
Oh, she sees everything.
And she doesn't let it go.
She completely steals the scene. While sipping a lemonade, her player types out a sequence where Alexandra secretly follows Sir Eric, pickpockets his heavy coin purse to secretly fund Thomas's Golden Hawks.
Wow.
And even steals his tournament favor tokens.
That is cold.
And then she just sits there, happily plotting to return the tokens to him later, completely anonymously, just to make him incredibly paranoid.
That is amazing.
It really proves that the pen, or in this case, the pickpocket, is definitely mightier than the sword.
It's a brilliant piece of character work. It showcases her agency and her sheer ruthlessness, but in a way that perfectly aligns with her royal, untouchable status.
She gets away with it easily.
Exactly. She fights with leverage, not weapons.
Meanwhile, the actual threat, the Black Knight, is just sitting quietly in the corner of the tavern.
The one who started all this.
Right. So Thomas finally walks over and confronts her. She formally introduces herself as Muren Rudhain.
I love that name.
It's beautiful. It means little red one born of the sea. And all the tension that started this whole story just evaporates.
I like that.
Yeah. She isn't an assassin. She isn't some grand villain trying to conquer the kingdom. She's just a tired working class traveler.
Oh, wow.
She explains she just wants the tournament prize money so she can finally settle down, buy a home, and stop fighting monsters for her next meal.
Which is a beautiful subversion of the initial trope.
Completely flips it.
The menacing alien knight from the opening act is really just a pragmatic warrior caught in the gears of the kingdom's politics.
The resolution is surprisingly neat and tidy, too. They all move to a Golden Hawk's safe house. Mirren swears a formal oath to Alexandra that she won't harm any Fae with her iron weapons.
That ties up the iron threat.
Exactly. And in exchange, Alexandra gives her a royal favor token and promises to bet on her in the tournament.
Very mutually beneficial.
Yeah, the political mystery is solved. The fantasy adventure concludes.
But that's just the adventure.
Right.
The framing device of the log, you know, the story within a story returns here. And it reveals a totally different kind of mystery.
Oh, man. Yeah.
One that was left entirely unresolved.
Exactly. So we flash forward back to the present day at the Hawksmoor Archives.
Back to where we started.
Right. And this is where the emotional core of this entire transcript just drops on you out of nowhere.
It really does hit hard.
So Lord Thomas has finished telling the story. His friends are bantering. There's this lighthearted chat where Thomas jokes about a sponge bath for a character named Ahern, and they discuss an upcoming dance.
Just normal everyday conversation.
Right. And we get a quick summary of what happened to everyone. Redmayne went on to win the tourney and officially join House May, while Alexandra grew up and ended up studying magic.
The players are actively demonstrating the passage of time here.
Yeah, showing how things evolved.
They are reminding each other and the reader that these avatars have lived entire complex lives since that tournament years ago.
But then the tone shifts dramatically.
It gets very quiet.
Very quiet. Everyone leaves the archives. The text describes Thomas completely alone. He walks over to bookshelves, extinguishes the candle, and pulls out a faded, unsent parchment.
A letter.
Yeah. It's a letter written to Knight Redmayne years ago. And the transcript reveals the text of the letter to the reader.
What does it say?
It reads, "There are many things I have always wished to say to you. It's funny how certain dangers are so easy to face, but certain people."
Oh, wow.
Right. And the final action of the log is Thomas sighing in the dark, realizing he never sent the letter and never told her how he truly felt.
This raises an important question about the unique power of text-based role-playing.
What do you mean?
Well, in a traditional game or a short story, a romance is usually a plot point to be resolved. But because of the long-term nature of these campaigns, where players log in as these characters week after week, sometimes for years, you can develop an incredibly slow burn emotional reality.
So what does this all mean?
It means the investment is real.
Yeah. The emotional gut punch of this ending is just staggering to me. It's like finding a secret, heartbreaking diary entry hidden at the very back of an action-packed comic book.
That's a great analogy.
For all of Thomas's bravado, you know, for all his fearless exploring, his witty tavern comebacks, and his political maneuvering, he's carrying this quiet, unrequited romance.
Right beneath the surface.
And the player has likely carried that secret for years of real-time play.
And here is the truly fascinating part.
What's that?
The other players might not have even known about it until this specific scene was typed out into the chat room.
Wait, really? They might have been totally in the dark.
Exactly. That hidden vulnerability was sitting beneath the character's surface the entire time. It proves that collaborative storytelling isn't just about moving game pieces from point A to point B to solve a puzzle.
Right, it's not a board game.
No, it's about the emotional residue those puzzle pieces leave on the characters.
It really makes you think about the nature of the stories we tell together. And that brings us back to you, the listener.
Why does this matter today?
Exactly. Why does a random chat log from the early 2000s matter to you today? Whether you are prepping for a creative meeting, trying to figure out how your remote team communicates, or if you just really love a good story, this deep dive proves something fundamental.
And what's that?
The most engaging, memorable narratives aren't always top-down scripts dictated by a single visionary architect.
Definitely not.
They are often highly collaborative, slightly messy, and built entirely on shared improvisation.
Building the ship while sailing it.
Exactly. It's about taking the strange puzzle pieces someone else gives you, like the scent of iron, or a goat-headed sea giant, or a teenager stealing a coin purse, and building upon them instead of rejecting them.
It's about the active discipline of leaving space for others to contribute.
Yes.
It's allowing the minstrel to sing his song, the translator to decode the runes, and the princess to manipulate the board, trusting that the combined output will be richer than anything you could have written alone.
Exactly. And I want to leave you with a lingering thought about the digital permanence of these specific role-playing characters.
Okay.
We started by talking about the chaotic energy of building a ship while sailing it, weaving a story line by line in real time. But eventually, the sailing starts.
The campaign has to end.
Right, the campaign ends. If this one transcript from the early 2000s holds so much life, so much meticulous world building, and so much unspoken, unrequited emotion, well, what happens to these characters when the players log off for the very last time?
That is a haunting question.
Do Thomas, Redmayne, and Alexandra simply cease to exist? Or are they just frozen in the digital archives, standing completely still in the dark, waiting for a curious reader like you to log on and breathe life back into their world?